Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu is probably the biggest name at this year's Hay Festival. It was Nelson Mandela who said of him, "Sometimes strident, often tender, never afraid and seldom without humour, Desmond Tutu will always be the voice of the voiceless." Tutu's tireless anti-apartheid campaigning during the 1980s eventually won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1995. He was chosen by President Mandela to chair South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up to investigate crimes committed during the apartheid regime. Desmond Tutu is no stranger to controversy, and he hit the headlines again in the run-up to South Africa's recent elections, this time for decrying presidential hopeful Jacob Zuma, who went on to win despite facing allegations of rape and corruption. Guardian columnist Gary Young interviewed Desmond Tutu in New York just before he headed for the lush green valleys of Hay-on-Wye.
A while back, and a number of times, you said that you were winding down, that you were going to lead a more contemplative life and stop racing around. Here you are in New York. You're on your way to Hay. I'm wondering whatever happened to that.
I'm wondering as well. In many ways, I think when you Nobel Peace Laureate, you have an obligation to humankind, to society. And you are able to say things which people might take more seriously than if you were not a Nobel Laureate. And with a world that faces so much conflict and suffering, that seems to be a place for those who just might help us change tech. But I am still deeply longing for a quiet life. And I really mean it when I say I'm really going to try, my wife says, of course, she's heard me say that several times, but I'm going to try next year and be ruthless. But you see, what do you do when the Prime Minister of, say, Solomon Islands writes and says, please, can you come and be with us when we launch our Truth and Reconciliation Commission? It seems so mean, so hard-hearted in a way to say no.
You've also said that you love to be loved and that is a that is a problem for, or at least I'm imagining that can be a problem, and it's not always obvious to the outsider that you love to be loved, because you keep saying things that get you in so much trouble.
I think most of us would tend to say that they prefer if they are popular than if they are unpopular. But I know for myself that it has tended to be a weakness, the weakness that wants to enjoy the limelight, a weakness that would frequently want to make you soften perhaps things that are hard that you need to say. Many people would be surprised if I said to them that, in fact, I am quite shy. You know, it doesn't look like it.
Yet. Yeah.
You look at your smile. I mean, I think yes, you reckon what? But in fact, yes, I'm not quite as ebullient, and one of the weaknesses of that, when you link it with the wanting to be loved, would be that you hate being confrontational. One has had to be confrontational, and that is contrary to my temperament. I mean, many would say, what? When he could be so strident and be so acerbic in his attacks on others, it's put on.
It's put on, it's a performance, is it?
Well, not in the sense that it's histrionics. It is that I have actually got to get myself into that particular mode. My inclination would have been keeping quiet.
That urge, if you like, or default position of desiring to be quiet, to be unseen, to kind of just get along. To what extent do you think that plays a role in some of the things that you find yourself talking about, whether it's war or Rwanda or of people thinking, oh, I don't want to ruffle too many feathers. To what extent do you think that thing that you recognise in yourself is kind of present in other people in a way that can be dangerous at times?
Well, I mean, you've got to deal with people as you encounter them and as you seem to understand them to be, and not spend far too much time in psychoanalyzing them. I think all of us are a great deal more complex. And so whenever I go into a situation, I try and ensure that is something that has been soaked in prayer. And I would usually have told people that I am going to be going, and especially nuns or monks, I would say, please remember me in your prayers. One goes into most of these situations not as a lonesome, you know, the lone ranger. And that also helps in not taking too much credit to oneself. I mean, if one manages, for instance, to facilitate whatever, and you wanted to think that, aren't I the cat's whiskers, I've done wonderfully well. You may have been an important ingredient, but you're not the only, you know. It might just help to keep your head the right size.
In South Africa, back home, you've managed at different times pretty much to get into a tussle with everybody there, including Nelson Mandela, Thabo Mbeki. I just want to read you something you said about Jacob Zuma. You know what's coming, don't you? You said, I pray that someone will be able to counsel him that the most dignified, selfless thing, the best thing he could do for a land he loves deeply, is to declare his decision not to take further part in a succession race for his party. Mm. Clearly that didn't happen. how do you feel about that now?
I think, I mean, that many have felt uneasy about the fact that he had these charges hanging over his head. And I think it is still unfortunate that the way they were dealt with was not through a court, but as it were, administratively. And so there will always be this shadow hanging over him. And that's a shame. He's been elected by people to be our president. He is hugely popular with a large section of our community. And so the thing to do is to say, let us wait and see. Let us give him the chance to prove himself, hoping against hope that what we might have feared will not, in fact, eventuate.
I, for one, would not be able to hold my head high if a person with such supporters were to become my president. Is your head high now?
It's water under the bridge. Mm-hmm. And we've got this new reality. Let's see what happens. At this stage, I'm perhaps neutral.
That doesn't happen very often with you, does it?
You wished that we could, we might have handled it slightly differently, but then politics is politics.
Why do you think it was? What forces came about to make his victories possible, do you think?
I think one was a very positive thing that, you know, we are constantly castigating African presidents who want to be presidents for life. And I think the rejection of Thabo Mbeki going for a third term and so somehow seeking to ensconce himself as a president in perpetuity was a good thing. There was also a reaction, I think, to his style. Many experienced him as perhaps too English, you know.
I'm going to take that personally.
Well, he, you know, didn't carry his heart on his sleeves, as, say, most of our people tend to do, that he appeared to be aloof, and many found that off-putting. And then he had made a number of enemies, people he had treated badly, Cyril Ramaphosa, Tokyo Sohwale, and I think there were people who had their knife into him. Jacob Zuma is warm and engages people. And of course, as you can see, I mean, when he's dancing on the stage, people warm to him in a way that they didn't to Thabo Mbeki. And so all of those factors militated against Thabo.
You said there that you hope against hope, which suggests that you're not very hopeful, or maybe not as hopeful as you might be.
No. I mean, it's just being realistic. It's saying we're facing very serious problems. I mean, like the rest of the world, we're facing the economic downturn, but we've also got problems that are peculiar to us. There's a very high incidence of HIV and AIDS. We are the epicenter, really, in many ways. We have high levels of crime, levels of poverty that are unacceptable, and unemployment. And then the usual bang shoot of corruption. So they have a very full plate to deal with. One has to wish them well for everybody's sake. They have to succeed.
Hope. You are now in the land of hope with the election of President Obama.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that having happened? Did you think...
I mean, it's such a fantastic thing. It's a fantastic thing for the United States. I mean, Americans are no longer Canadians. I mean, masquerading as they used to do because they were so ashamed of being identified as American. He's filled Americans with a new pride in their country, where previously they behaved like bully boys. Everybody says, no, you shouldn't really invade Iraq now. Let's see whether there is the evidence of weapons of mass destruction. No, America says, go jump in the lake. There's the Kyoto Protocol on, they don't sign. There's the Rome Statute setting up the International Criminal Court. They don't sign that. Now, I mean, people believe that you are going to have an America that is a leader of the world, not by obstreperous, not by being a bully, but by being collaborative. African Americans are walking with a new spring in their step. In many ways, it is a crazy country in that, I mean, you have the Ku Klux Klan here. You can have a black man dragged to his death behind a truck. And yet, amazingly, acceleratingly, something that no one really believed was going to be happening soon, is to have as an incumbent, young, but one who has such a presence. I mean, you know, he is presidential. He's warm, but you won't take any liberties with him.
I mean, I'm wondering whether there's any deja vu for you here. I was in South Africa for the 94 election. Yeah. And I mean, different in many, many ways. But yeah. the similarities I'm thinking of was the spring in the step and the notion, Mandela saying, no longer will we be the skunk of the world, that
yes.
a country could
yes.
re-enter and a kind of international conversation with its head held high. And that now, 15 years later, has a lot on its plate, as you said. I'm wondering if those parallels ring true to you, if there are kind of concerns for you in those parallels in terms of how things have gone in South Africa and how yeah. things could
but
be.
But I think that you always have the theoretical possibility of total disillusionment and disappointment. I think, I mean, that the indications are in the other direction. He's a very astute person, and I think he has sought to find those next to him, near to him, who are competent, more than competent. But I mean, no, I mean, it is important that he has filled people of color also with a new sense of who they are. That's great.
Truth and reconciliation.
Mm.
I mean, to what extent do you think there can be reconciliation without truth?
No, none. I mean, not really genuine. It will always be a very, very shaky thing. There can't really be reconciliation if you do not have a full disclosure of the truth or as much of it as you are able to reveal.
So did that process work in South Africa, do you think?
I would say that if we hadn't gone through a process such as the one that we did, flawed as it was the best thing that we could accomplish at the time. Without it, I don't think we would be where we are now.
So do you think there has been reconciliation?
If you say perfect reconciliation, I don't think, except in a few instances, because reconciliation is not an event, really. It's a process. It could not be that a commission, however successful, would be able to have dealt with the anguish and agony of having suffered for over 300 years. I mean, the commission itself looked only at a very limited period, 1960 to 1994, the inauguration of Nelson Mandela. In a way, it was arbitrary. It was almost an artificial thing we were doing. We're saying we want to look at a portion of the past and use that as a kind of paradigm for dealing with other portions of our history. And so it would be totally unrealistic to imagine that we would be completely reconciled. It's going to take years, really.
At different moments in history, different things have become the focal point for tension, nationhood or race or tribe. And it feels in this period that religion has become a focal point. Mm. You've devoted your life to religion, and I'm wondering whether you think that's true, and if so, why do you think that has happened?
Well, I mean, if you are saying that we are at a period when sometimes people have seemed to use religion to justify whatever. I mean, especially acts of terrorism. And so given a great deal of credence to religious intolerance, then you have to say, yes, accept that religion isn't what we imagine it to be. The fact of the matter is that as a group that Kofi Annan set up came to agree, it was not the faiths that were a problem. It was the faithful. A knife is a morally neutral thing. I mean, if it's sitting on the table here, it's neither good nor bad. When I use it for cutting up bread, it's a good thing. If I use it to stick in your gut, it's a bad thing. Religion is the same.